For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to another episode of All My Best Friends Are Digital, a podcast about video games and the stories they tell. My name is Caitlin, and I'm here with my co-host, Mark. Mark, what's up?
What's up is what is always up, Caitlin. It is what was up last week. It is what is up now. It is what is up next week. And that is the video games, Caitlin. It is what is always up. How are you doing?
Not too shabby myself. Thank you. Today, we will be discussing games you've been playing lately, followed by gaming opinions on old school funware, our retro segment, where we're going to be discussing The Magical Quest starring Mickey Mouse. Then we'll move on to our feature game, Wildermyth. And finally, we'll wrap up by shouting out the games that we are looking forward to. So, Mark, what have you been playing lately?
As my mother could no doubt tell you, or indeed almost anyone of my acquaintance, I am not limited to one thing a week in terms of goofing around. And so I've been playing lots of retro games. In part, I got a new handheld emulation gizmo because sitting at roughly a couple dozen, I feel like I clearly don't have enough. And I've been playing on the iNeo Pocket S, which is a lovely device and has got a lot of power. And so I've been playing a lot of PS2 games. In particular, I've been playing Prince of Persia: The Sands of Time in a lovely widescreen format with a resolution bump. I actually found out there's going to be a remake planned to be published in the next couple of years. But what do I care? It's like a modern remaster, so I already get to play Sands of Time. I commented when we talked before about Prince of Persia that I've loved the series and I've loved the trilogy done by Ubisoft. The Sands of Time was the first of that trilogy. It was published in 2003, done by Ubisoft Montreal, which is the best of the Ubisofts, clearly.
Clearly.
Jordan Mechner was the one who wrote the script, he of the original Prince of Persia, and I'd forgotten just how charming and how brisk the storytelling is in pretty much any Jordan Mechner game, but I kind of forgot how Mechner-esque it still is, because Jordan Mechner has a very, very firm opinion that if you're going to be telling a story in a video game, you can have cutscenes, that's fine, but they had better not drag on too long. And I like games with overlong cutscenes on occasion. We talk about them all the time. But he is very much of the opinion that the pacing should be kept up. And that is very evident in Prince of Persia: Sands of Time. So in many ways, it's kind of like a fusion of some of his sort of comparatively antiquated late 20th century ideas of video game storytelling, coupled with slightly more modern technology and aesthetics. That having been said, it is very much a game that was published in 2003, and you do get to wrestle with the camera all the time. Now, you don't die as a function of the camera being not where you wanted it to be, which, in fairness, modern games sometimes do. We talked about this in the context of Sifu. I've lost a number of runs of Sifu by virtue of the camera not behaving properly. But you do have to finesse the camera all the time. Contrast this with a sort of contemporary Prince of Persia: Sands of Time, Ico, which I learned was actually an inspiration for the design team. They had a number of meetings where they just sat down and they're like, okay, this is what Ico does. This is how we want to do things. Let's take inspiration from them in terms of level design and a number of other elements, which is very much for the good and quite frankly unsurprising given that they're both kind of similar games. They would be called cinematic platformers, I guess. I don't really like that term, but I guess as far as a description of things, it's definitely better than action adventure, which means in the context of video games, almost precisely nothing. Ultimately, it is just a joy to revisit Prince of Persia: Sands of Time. I love the platforming. Yes, it's stupid to run along walls. It doesn't look any more natural or plausible now than it did 20 years ago, but it leads to some great level design and some marvelous platforming. And it uses the same, I learned this today, it uses the same game engine that Beyond Good and Evil did.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, the Jade engine. So that partially it helps explain why they both look so good. I mean, it was a pretty solid engine as far as graphical fidelity goes. They've aged very well graphically. I talked a couple weeks ago how I really liked the sort of sidekick element of Beyond Good and Evil. You know, the person who follows you around and can get to the door that you can't or to hit the switch. And again, Prince of Persia: Sands of Time does that in spades. Pharah is kind of your sidekick, and she fights with you and crawls through things that you can't and activates things that you can't and occasionally negs your performance and or makes some snarky comments about how you're clearly incompetent, which leads into one of those charming elements. And if you've never played Prince of Persia: Sands of Time, I really think you should give it a shot, because the framing device, the overall plot framing device, is so cool and so well done. The prince, who parenthetically is never named, is narrating the game. The entire game is presented as though he is telling that story. And so there's this kind of moments of humor. If you plummet to your death, then as you're given the option to load or continue or quit or what have you, you hear the prince jump in and says, no, it didn't go that way. And it's just really funny. And on top of that, those who have played the game, this conceit, this narrative framing, pays off in a surprisingly satisfying way near the end. I really like the plot structure as well as the specific elements of the plot. It's very appealing. Other than that, I'd say that the combat is a bit sluggish, but whatever. I mean, you're there for the platforming most of the time. There's some good bits of the combat. The rewinding elements and the time manipulation is clever. But ultimately, a lot of it is a little more stagnant than I would have liked and is not nearly as fluid, dynamic, and well done as a lot of the platforming is concerned. So this is the first game in a trilogy. The second game, Warrior Within, is some hot garbage. they take all the charm, all the interesting conceit, all the lovely setting and framing, and they just run it through a generic turn-of-the-century wood chipper. This was immortalized, I think, very well in a Penny Arcade comic of the time, where the protagonist says, "I seethe with generic rage," and that is completely apropos. They kind of brought it back in the third. I don't know if I'm going to keep playing the rest of the games. I'd be very surprised if I found the nerve to go and do more than about 5 seconds of Warrior Within. I'm probably just going to reload it and be like, oh, geez, this nonsense again. But I might go and do the third one, because the third one kind of brought things back for the good. But I've been having a great time with Prince of Persia: Sands of Time. It is held up in my memory, both the good and the bad. And it is available on GOG, it's available on modern platforms, broadly speaking, or emulating on PS2. PS2 emulation is very, very stable and mature, and I would encourage everyone who hasn't given it a shot to give it a try. If this is the kind of game that you like, it is a very influential game, and it's held up extraordinarily well. And if you've played it before, I would encourage you to revisit it. It is as charming as you remember, if your reaction is anything like mine. And as I recall, Caitlin, you have not played Prince of Persia: Sands of Time.
I haven't, you're right.
But then again, cinematic platformers aren't nearly as much your bag as they are mine, so.
Yeah, but, I mean, I'm always intrigued by it, hearing other people talk about it. I have a very long list of stuff I want to get to eventually, and that's on there. We'll see if it happens.
I will not hold my breath.
Yeah, that's probably for the best.
And clearly you can tell that it's a retro game because there are no dogs or cats to pet.
Yes, that's a must.
Camera problems, no dog, no cat, no fishing. That is what it is to be a retro game. We talked before about how it's difficult to define it. I think I just defined it.
I think you did. Yeah, camera problems. You mentioning that made me realize, like, yeah, that used to be every single game that I played. And I very rarely have that problem nowadays.
So problem, I think, is being a little uncharitable, but somewhat accurate. You have to finesse it a lot. But it is seldom the case that you feel like you're actively struggling with the thing.
Mm-hmm.
There were lots of games of that era where you really felt like you were struggling. And to contrast it to Ico, just a callback to many weeks before, the thing with the camera work in Ico is kind of sort of the same kind of conceit about the camera work, quote unquote, in the early Resident Evil games, which is you just have to trust that the camera angle that they're giving you is the one that they wanted to give you. And
yeah.
they're not leaving anything out. That this is they framed it this way, they meant it that way, because in Ico you can control the camera a little.
Yeah, you can like lean it one way or another.
Right, and the only time you really need to press a button to do anything with the camera in Iko is when Yorda has been captured and you need to know where she is because she's not on the screen. But in the context of Prince of Persia, Sands of Time, you're constantly fiddling with it just so you can see where you need to go. So it's not like you're going to die because the camera isn't where you need it to be, mm-hmm. but you're constantly finessing it. Now, in fairness, I mean, I've been playing recently a tiny little bit of Doom Eternal too, and I've been Doom Eternal as well. And so I've been wondering, why is it that in an action-adventure game, like, see, there you go, I used the term. I said it was useless, and then I just deployed it. Language is an insidious thing. You have to be very careful about what you let in your lexicon, because it's like a virus. Why is it a terrible thing that I have to constantly be fiddling with the other joystick in the context of a game like Prince of Persia, but in first-person games, we just accept it? And I'm sure there are a lot of reasons, but suffice to say, there is a difference, and it's there. And it is not the kind of thing that a modern game would have the same set of assumptions with. Mm-hmm. So, progress. People say that the world isn't getting better. I can prove to you that that's not true. Third-person adventure games have better cameras now than they used to. Have I made you feel better about the world, Caitlin?
A little bit.
I'm familiar with that tone. That is the tone of my being humored. So, Caitlin, what have you been up to lately?
All right, so there's two games that I've been spending my time with mostly this last week. One of them is Final Fantasy II. So way back in the day, I talked about that I had like a Final Fantasy quote-unquote book club where we were going to play the mainline series from the first one. We did the first one ages ago, and then the Final Fantasy XIV expansion came out. And almost all of us are Final Fantasy XIV players, so we got majorly sidetracked, but we're right. going to be discussing Final Fantasy II today, actually. Yeah, it's finally happening. So I spent the time. I beat Final Fantasy II. I cheated, question mark. Final Fantasy II is weird because they completely changed the leveling system. So you no longer like do a fight, get experience, and go from level 1 to level 2. You kind of gain stats that you use. So if you use magic, you get magic-related stats. If you hit things, you get strength. If you get hit, get more health. If you block, then you get more evasion. It's a little weird. There's a bunch of strategies online for how to make it a little bit easier, because if you just kind of stumble through the game without knowing what you're doing, it can be quite difficult, I guess. So anyway, I followed one of those strategies, which involved just equipping shields on everyone, just shields for days in order to raise your evasion. And then you can go do what you want in the latter half of the game.
So this is following a guide online. This is completely not like following a tutorial.
Yeah, it's fine. Actually, somebody else read that and then told me about it. So
fair enough.
If I'm being honest. So yeah, anyway, I ended up doing that. The game is really different Final Fantasy I in a lot of ways. You have real characters with names. The story is significantly more coherent. You don't have to find the one non-player character that looks the same as all the other non-player characters, but actually has useful information to give you. So in general, I think in a lot of ways from Final Fantasy I, it was an upgrade, but I think they really missed with the leveling system.
In their defense, it's really interesting from a historical perspective because, so yeah, you've got like the early stuff like Dragon Warrior, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Final Fantasy I, and they're kind of sort of setting the template. And so I really respect they didn't know when they made Final Fantasy I that they were going to be making essentially more or less, and I'm very sorry, Final Fantasy stands, more or less the same combat system from Final Fantasies 3 until 10.
Yep.
Spanning multiple hardware generations. Years and years through history, like they didn't know that it's like, all right, we're setting things up forever. And so, yeah, it's Final Fantasy II. They're like, hey, let's mix things up a bit. And sometimes in the sequel, you end up with something that completely redefines the genre for the better, like Street Fighter II. And sometimes you end up with Final Fantasy II or The Warrior Within, and you kind of mess up with something that turns out that you didn't need to mess with in the first place.
Yeah, so I respect that they tried something, even if it generally was not well received by almost anyone. The other way in which I cheated, because, I mean, just equipping shields and everyone, that's not really a cheat. That's a
It's an exploit.
Clever use of game mechanics. Yeah.
There you go. Exploit.
But I did use some of the boost options in the menu because I wanted to make sure that I could finish the game when I was playing it yesterday. So
this is the Pixel remaster, right?
Yes, it is. Yeah, I am playing the Pixel remaster. You cannot do that in any of the other versions of the game that I know of.
Right.
But I boosted my attributes experience gain so that I would get more strength, more health, blah, 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 blah. So anyway.
You could probably do something similar with a cheat in RetroArch for what it's worth, but that's more advanced emulation stuff.
Yep, that makes sense. So yeah, that was Final Fantasy II.
Is there going to be a pause between this and Final Fantasy III, or you're going to straight on into the III?
I don't know yet. We're going to be discussing Final Fantasy II later today, and then we'll decide what we're going to do with III. III, I think, is supposed to be longer. Oof. And given that it took us months to get through Final Fantasy II, we have to set expectations. So
okay. So it's not like you're going to be cheating on me all the time with your Final Fantasy group.
Yeah, not all the time. So I think
this makes me feel better. All right. So what else have you been up to, Caitlin?
Okay. I've also been playing Luma Island. Luma Island is a cozy game. I mentioned it last week, I believe, and I didn't want to get into it because I knew I'd be talking about it more. But like many cozy games, you, the character, have grown tired of your life in the big city, and you decide to take it easy by doing loads of manual labor. Not sure I understand it, but here it is. So the easiest comparison to make is to Stardew Valley or Harvest Moon, but it's not quite right because the point of those games is to clearly have a magnificent farm. And Luma Island, honestly, so in the amount of time that I've been playing Luma Island, I've been playing multiplayer with my friend Kate. Farming has been entirely optional. It's not the main way of making money. In Stardew Valley and Harvest Moon, you tend to grow your crops, and sometimes you, especially in Stardew, you can cook with them, and you know, give them as gifts or whatever.
I'm told that mayonnaise is the sure route to riches.
But yeah, in this game, you grow them, and then there wasn't really anything to do with them. It turns out, if you have certain professions, then you can use them, but you have to sign up to be a baker or a brewer, and then you'll be able to have things that you can do with them. So anyway, farming, pretty much entirely optional. I started out with the fishing profession, and my friend chose treasure hunter. Fishing seemed fun at first, but it kind of sucks. Maybe just like real life.
Fun at first, kind of sucks. That's a pretty ringing condemnation.
Yeah, I mean, so it seemed neat at first. So, you cast your line, and the fish comes over and takes a nibble, and then... This is not at all like real fishing. You have to chase the fish around with the bobber once it's bitten. So you just have to follow it. And after following it for a certain amount of time, you've caught the fish, can reel it in. I thought that upgrading the fishing rod would make the amount of time that you need to chase the fish shorter, but it doesn't, or it doesn't seem to anyway. If it does, it's by a very small amount. So it gets real boring when you have to catch like 10, 15 fish in order to make your fishing recipes, or sorry, to create your like fishing plates or whatever for the fishing profession. I don't know. So it started out, it seemed fun at first, like, oh, I get to chase the fish. But yeah, I don't want to do that for long periods of time.
Is the expectation that you kind of specialize, or is it the case that there's just a smattering of different mechanisms and you're expected to just dabble in each of them?
So I think you're mostly expected to specialize. Your very first profession is free, but after that, it costs money, and it's an increasing amount of money. It increases exponentially. So your first one's free. I think your second profession costs like 500 gold, and then it's like, oh, 10,000, by the way. And then I think 25,000. So it goes up pretty steeply. So
I'm imagining some sort of anthropomorphic animal character in a trench coat who says, hey, kid, you want a profession? The first taste is free. Is that kind of the vibe?
That's basically it. It is a balding old man at the town hall.
Okay, now things have gotten real gross.
I mean, he's not opening his trench coat, if that helps.
That makes things a lot better. Okay, you may proceed.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, professions are the main way to make money. It's a little weird because I thought professions would be a little deeper, but basically in professions... You go, so for fishing, I catch a bunch of fish, I get a couple other materials, I can make these platters, The only thing you can do with them is sell them for money. You can't use them for stat boosts or gift them to people. There's no friendship or romance mechanic in this like there is in Harvest Moon and Stardew. One of the big things that this game does do is they do a little bit more, I hesitate to call it platforming, but it's kind of platformy. There's no jumping, but there are temples that you can go into and they have traps. So there'll be like, you know, spike traps that you have to walk over when the spikes retract. There'll be darts coming from the sides that you'll have to avoid as you make your way through the temple. So there's a little bit more like adventure-y stuff you can do in this game. And that's been pretty fun to do with a friend. In general, I think multiplayer would be the way to go if you are interested in a game like this, because it can get real grindy. Granted, they did have a quality of life patch that made it significantly less grindy. Some people complained about making it less hard. I don't think people play this game for...
for the challenge.
Yeah, and even if you did, it's... time sync is not a challenge. It's just... like, you know?
So let me get this straight. Luna Island is a game very much in the same mold as Stardew Valley, but unlike Stardew Valley, you have to activate certain kinds of professions, and it's progressively more difficult to unlock other professions, and the professions are kind of shallow and repetitive?
Yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't sound too awesome.
I know. The strongest part to the game to me is the temples that you get to explore. There's lots of treasure chests. Unfortunately, a lot of the treasure chests can be kind of underwhelming. Like, the amount of work that the two of us have put in for certain things, only to open up the chest and be like, oh, cool, I got some more tool tokens. Love that. The game has a lot of potential, so I'm hoping that eventually some of these issues get fixed or maybe a little bit more depth gets added to the professions. For now, it's been fun, but... there's also lots of other games like it that I think are probably better.
You sounded a lot more positive about Core Keeper, for one.
Yes, I still love Core Keeper.
Yeah, I noticed that Luna Island has been really, really high on the Steam rankings lately. A lot of people are playing it. And it does seem strange to take, again, this well-worn genre where there's tons of different kinds of things to do, and for them to say, no, you're just going to do one thing at a time. And because when you talk about fishing... yes, back in the day, there were some like arcade fishing games with those weird artificial fishing poles and things. But fishing is normally the 10th or 11th kind of thing you do in a video game on top of a whole bunch of other core mechanisms instead of the one thing you do.
Yeah. So, okay. To be fair, there are other things that you will do. There's multiple biomes in this game. You have to progress through each one. Generally, at the end of the temple for... a given biome, you're going to get an item. I think it's at the end of the temple. It might be somewhere else. Anyway, the gist is that it doesn't really matter. You will find an item that lets you unlock the next biome. And exploring those has been fun.
So why wouldn't everyone be a treasure hunter then? It sounds like they're the people who get to go and do the interesting thing.
Well, everybody does get to do that. It's weird. You can do a lot of things in the game. The profession stuff is purely limited to crafting.
Oh,
so
I see.
While I do other things in the game, I was actually collecting all sorts of materials for treasure hunters, even though I wasn't a treasure hunter yet. And when I did unlock that profession, I was able to get through a lot of the early levels really quickly because I already had a bunch of the materials.
I see.
I don't know. It's weird. One good thing, unlimited bag space, which is really good for a person like me who picks up everything. It's like, thank you for not making that like a big game mechanic.
So many games seem to think that what I want to do with my spare time, and this has been true of games ranging from Stardew Valley to Bethesda games to Resident Evil 4, for crying out loud, and they think that what I want to do is manage things in my pockets, and that is not a thing that I've ever wanted to do in real life or in a video game.
Never. I always play strength characters in games like Skyrim because I don't want to deal with that. Like, it's like, yes, let me carry 300 pounds of stuff at all times.
Yeah, the perk for extra carrying capacity, it tends to be one of my first perks in Bethesda games. Absolutely. Yep. What's your prognosis on Luma Island, especially when, as we've said, there's already millions of other games, such as Core Keeper, to compete with it?
Because I've been playing this with my friend Kate, and I don't get to play a lot of other games with her, I will probably at least, quote, finish it. I don't know what finishing the game looks like. We are right. in the final biome now, so we're pretty close. It's worth spending the time because I get to do it with a friend. If I were solo, I probably wouldn't.
That is, frankly, one of the best reasons to play a video game. So that makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let us move on to gaming opinions on old school funware, what we here at MFAB call Goof, because we, and by we I mean I, love our silly acronyms. We're going to be talking about The Magical Quest starring Mickey Mouse. This is a game I played on the Super Nintendo back in the day. It was developed by Capcom and released in 1992. There was a Game Boy Advance version, but it is, shall we say, in French, le garbage, which more sophisticated bilingual listeners will understand. I love the framing of The Magical Quest starring Mickey Mouse. It is so ridiculous. Perhaps before going on, I should ask Caitlin. I didn't ask this when we talked about The Lion King. Are you a Disney person? If you have to think about it, you're not.
Yeah, I was going to say, I wouldn't necessarily say, like, I'm not a Disney person, because I feel like that implies, like, a distaste. But
sure.
I'm also not a capital D Disney, capital P person.
Let me just put it this way. I have a number of people in my broad acquaintance, some of whom I maintain dim contact with through social media, and more or less all that I see are itineraries to and from Florida and pictures at a certain resort / amusement park. Mm. And if your response to "are you a Disney person" is a pause and an the answer is no, you are not a Disney person. Now, I understand what you're saying. Like, that kind of gently implies a degree of distaste, but you know the kind of person I'm talking about.
I absolutely do, yes.
Why don't you give us a rundown on what's going on in The Magical Quest starring Mickey Mouse?
Yeah, so The Magical Quest starring Mickey Mouse begins with Mickey and Goofy throwing a ball back and... Ball? Frisbee? I think a ball.
They're playing catch.
They're playing catch, yes. And they're torturing poor Pluto because he's just running back and forth between them and he never gets to get the ball.
Don't dogs like that? Like, he gets to run around? I don't know.
They usually like to get the ball eventually, but okay, anyway.
You're the expert of this topic. I wouldn't know.
Goofy throws it and Mickey whiffs his catch and it bounces off his head and goes behind him and Pluto goes running after it. And for some reason, they lose track of Pluto real fast. And he's missing. And Goofy's all like, yeah, don't worry, I'll help. And Mickey's like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, buddy, I'm sure you'll be super helpful. Yeah. In fairness, it is not entirely certain how sapient the dog is.
Yes.
Like, we don't know it's like his level of intelligence. They play fast and loose with that all the time. But yeah, he ends up in some sort of weird magical alternate dimension. He has been kidnapped by, and this is probably, I don't know why, I have such enthusiasm for this name.
Yes.
For a villain or for anyone else. He is kidnapped for reasons not explained by Emperor Pete.
Yep.
Can we just stand to just appreciate the absurdity of this magical fantasy warlock warlord called Emperor Pete? It's great.
Yeah, it killed me. I was like, oh my god, it's not even Peter. Like, that would at least be something, but no, it's Pete.
And what follows is a platforming game where you play as Mickey Mouse, and you can unlock new outfits, which give him new abilities. He starts out being able to spin things real fast, which sounds pretty useless, but is actually pretty handy, all things considered.
Yeah.
And then he eventually evolves into, like, an alternative... like, sequel to the Village People, or perhaps, like, a young child's wish fulfillment of a series of careers, specifically wizard, then firefighter, then mountaineer. And
yeah.
You can swap between these outfits at any time. A little privacy curtain arrives out of nowhere because the mouse, who mostly parades around naked, doesn't want to let you watch him change, and then he pops out and he's got new abilities. And that is the key gameplay gimmick in this platformer. So, as a firefighter, you can... shoot your fire hose. As a mountaineer, you're kind of sort of playing Bionic Commando, except not really.
I thought it was adorable. I didn't get to the firefighter or the mountaineer costumes, but I did unlock the wizard costume. So my biggest complaint is I really wanted to be able to control when I run, and I couldn't. And I understand that the game is perfectly balanced around that, but... that drove me crazy at first until I finally accepted, like, Caitlin, you can't do it. You can't control it. It's fine. Just move on. Yeah, I loved that you could, like, grab the fruit from the tree and then spin it. And then it would, like, make you float up into the air. I thought that was super cool. Being able to spin enemies and knock them into other enemies and kill them. It was really neat, and the platforming felt pretty good. I didn't have too many instances like in The Lion King where I was like, oh, I definitely thought I jumped, and I guess I didn't. Okay, I'm dead now.
Few platformers are as bad as The Lion King, as we addressed at the time. And I think pretty good is a perfect way to put it, because, look, let us speak as adults, let us acknowledge the grim truth, in that almost any platformer pales in comparison to Super Mario World. And if you're going to be on the Super Nintendo, obviously the shadow of Super Mario World looms large.
Yeah.
Super Mario World has a billion levels, and all of them are awesome, as opposed to The Magical Quest starring Mickey Mouse, which only has six worlds with 3 to 4 levels each. And as you say, it's pretty good. You can't really control when you run. You only run when you come off of a slope. I never really... I played it for a few hours. I replayed most of it. I still wasn't 100% sure how far I could jump. Like, there are these instances where you have to jump up over a platform, and I'm like, that's way too high, and I jump. It's like, oh, I can jump that high. I've been playing this game for 2 hours,
yeah. And
I still don't have a solid sense of how high I can jump. That's a sign of a little bit of sloppiness in your platforming.
Yeah, I would jump it. It's like, clearly Mickey did not clear that branch, but now he's on top of it, so okay, cool.
And so it gets the job done. It is very visually impressive. It's got a very good color palette. I mean, look, it's not the visual showstopper that The Lion King was, but this game you actually like playing, so there's that. And yeah, it's only got the same music on repeat, but whatever. It's got a lot of the Capcom/Disney aesthetic to it. It's very colorful and enjoyable. I've discovered something, though, replaying The Magical Quest starring Mickey Mouse. I've never been a particularly a Disney person. I pretended to be super into The Little Mermaid because the person I was kind of head over heels for in my class was. But setting all that aside, I don't have an antipathy for Disney stuff. But I think I hate Mickey Mouse.
Oh, no.
I'm kind of like Kendrick Lamar with Drake. I hate the way he talks. I hate the way he walks. I hate the way he sounds. I just seeing him, his speech rendered in text, like, gosh golly gee. And like, he drops all his G's in the contractions. And it's just, it's all nonsense. And like, he sounds like an imbecile. And I don't mean this in the sense of an unintelligent human. He sounds like some sort of a ridiculous caricature of human speech. It's like an AI was asked, how would someone talk if they wanted to fill the air with words and not say a thing, and that's what they would spit out? Anyway, I realize I'm getting a little too... But he's in the public domain now, so I guess that means I can make fun of him.
Yeah, that's how that works. Yeah, reading his speech was really funny because I could hear his exact voice in my head. And I wouldn't say that I have the level of distaste for Mickey Mouse that you do.
I've come to it recently. It's something I've learned about myself very recently. So I had completely forgotten, on top of that, just while I'm ragging on some of the overall conceits of The Magical Quest starring Mickey Mouse, is that it ends with the biggest cop-out of all time. It was all a dream, Caitlin.
No!
Spoiler alert, it was all a dream.
Really?
Yeah.
I hate that.
It's a Disney story. It's not like you had to paper over any plot holes with something to tie it all in at the beginning. It is literally called The Magical Quest, and it's about a missing dog and Emperor Pete. What made you feel the need to new heart the ending like that? I don't understand. I don't get it, but whatever, it's what they did. Once I read that, though, I remembered back in the day feeling so frustrated by that being the ending.
That is so uncool.
It is. I also didn't know that this was the start of a trilogy. I haven't played any of the subsequent two games. In 94, there was the Great Circus Mystery starring Mickey and Minnie. It's like they're getting paid by the letter here for the titles. And in 95, there was Disney's Magical Quest 3 starring Mickey and Donald. All of them have like this sort of costume conceit. They're all platformers done by various Capcom teams. And so I'm probably going to at least take a look at the later ones. Because as I said, this was a game I owned on the Super Nintendo and I played a lot of. It's kind of half held up, I think.
What systems are the other ones out on?
So they were both on the Super Nintendo. However, okay. the The third one was only released on the Super Famicom in Japan. It didn't get a domestic release except on the Game Boy Advance. And the problem with the Game Boy Advance adaptations is they did a poor job of adapting it to the different aspect ratio of the GBA screen. Because, and here we're going to get into aspect ratios. Thank you for asking about aspect ratios, Caitlin. As an aspect ratio nerd, I really appreciate it when you ask me about aspect ratios.
Yeah, anytime.
The Super Nintendo is either in a 3x4 or 7x8, depending on who you ask and on the context. And the Game Boy Advance was a 3x2, so almost widescreen, instead of an old CRT dimension, or 8x7 in the case of... It's complicated. But there's a variety of different ways you can do that. You can expand out the perspective sideways, or you can squash the perspective from top to bottom. And they squashed the perspective.
Mm.
And there's no reason why they had to do that. The GBA had all the hardware capabilities to run anything that the Super Nintendo could in the context of these platformers, but they instead made the bad call, and so consequently the games are much less playable.
That's gross. I hate that. I'm sorry.
Gross is absolutely a word for it. Do you know who would not put up with such a thing?
Who would not put up with such a thing?
Emperor Pete. I'm voting for him in the next election.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, he didn't squash the aspect ratio, so...
Yeah, the level design's pretty good. The movement's pretty good. All the, you know, the gameplay conceits are cute. My chief criticism, and this is often one, is that I wish that they'd done a little bit more with the gameplay conceit. Like, I would have really liked it if more often the levels you had to dynamically switch back and forth between the different costumes. Most of the time, you're just sticking with one. I will give a specific call out, though, to the boss fights. I think the boss fights in The Magical Quest starring Mickey Mouse are really cool. Emperor Pete puts his very characteristic mug on any number of large creatures, a snake, a spider, various other things, and they're just really cool, and they force you to make good use of whatever gimmick Mickey's costume currently lets him do.
Yeah, I really liked... So, I didn't get to do too many of the bosses. I think I came across three or four of them, but I really enjoyed the snake one. It did take me a minute at first. I thought I was supposed to hit him when he was red. That's when he can't be hit, so it was the opposite of that. But I figured it out.
Yeah, the snake fight is boss. I remember the snake fight. Are you familiar with the snake fight portion of your thesis defense?
No.
That's it. Sorry, it's an academic in-joke. It was a McSweeney's article.
Oh.
About a fake element of your thesis defense.
Nice.
So that is The Magical Quest starring Mickey Mouse. Turns out you can go home again. And now a brief break to hear from our sponsors.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
And we're back. And now we're going to go on to our feature game.
So our feature game is Wildermyth. So it's out on PlayStation 5, Switch, PS4, PC, pretty much everything as far as I'm aware.
The console editions were only released recently, though. It's been on PC since 2019, but the console is only for like a couple months, which is interesting.
Yeah, so I think it was early access in 2019. Is that right?
There was a period of early access.
Okay. And then full release in 2021 and developed by World Walker Games, LLC. So Wildermyth is, it's a crazy little game. It's a tactical RPG So there's various campaigns you can go through. You can either go through one of the set story campaigns, of which they have several. And then there's also some that are just completely random scenarios. So the storytelling is funny. There's obviously set story beats, but there's also a lot of random events that can happen. And each of those events can be a little bit randomized with what characters you're going to come across. Okay, I saw it was a tactical RPG and I was like, oh, the fights are going to take forever and this is going to be like, but I think I need to drop that stereotype I have in my head, because that's not the case with many tactical RPGs, and it wasn't really the case with this one. This game was really cool. I played my first one with just three of the random, you know, the random characters they gave me. I just hit randomize a number of times till I saw somebody that I thought looked cool. I love the little stories that you get to come up with. Mark, I believe you said you have a story that you would like to tell.
I do. So when I first read the premise of Wilvermyth, it was talking about how it offers procedurally generated narrative. It sounds honestly like one of those pitches that Peter Molyneux would do 10 years ago, right? Where he'd wander onto a stage somewhere, he would say, by playing this video game, you will attain spiritual enlightenment and be capable of telekinesis. And mm-hmm. The gaming press would be rapturous, and then the game would come out, and it was like a Tetris variant or something. And so I was reading this like, okay, Wilvermyth is a tactical RPG with procedurally generated narrative. We're going to tell unique stories with randomly generated characters and everything is customizable. I'm like, yeah, sure. Pull the other one. But I decided to give it a shot on the basis of reviews in 2021, shortly after it came out of early access. Mm-hmm. 2020 to 2021 was not a good time for me in my life. In point of fact, not to get too grim, I have some dissociative memory problems from that period. I went and visited you in Southern California during that period. I have dim memories of doing that, but a lot of it is a blur. And I only dimly remember playing Wilvermyth during that period. I played it for a few hours. And I always meant to go back to it, in part because of the vague memory that it mostly fulfills on its borderline impossible promise. It promises this thing that sounds too good to be true, and it mostly delivers. And what I'd completely forgotten about Wilvermyth is that it's a kind of magic when it works.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is custom. You can customize your character's name, their background, what they look like. You can customize what every single piece of equipment is called. You want to give your off-the-shelf shield a special name? Go ahead. Go and do that. You want to customize the personality of all your characters. You want to give them a unique bat. Whatever. Go ahead. Or the game will randomize it for you, and you are going to see a tremendous variety of difference there. Every once in a while, the magic gets shattered because the library, the inventory of random story beats that get sprinkled liberally throughout the campaign, sometimes they repeat.
Mm-hmm.
Not often, but often enough to remind you that this is a form of magic that cannot be sustained.
Yes.
And I just wasn't able to appreciate Wilvermyth when I first installed it and played it, because I wasn't really enjoying anything there. The only thing that I really remember really enjoying from that period of time is Elden Ring. Past that, it's all just kind of a blur of weird. I fell in love with it all over again. Just taking these random characters. Because every other tactical RPG in existence, pretty much every other version of this iteration, pretty much falls into the same dynamic as either something like Final Fantasy Tactics or something like Vandal Hearts. In Vandal Hearts, there are no characters you can create. Everyone you recruit is bespoke, made by the game. Okay. Then there's Final Fantasy Tactics. You have your plot-relevant characters and everybody else. And everybody else, they're never going to say anything or mean anything at all. Whereas in Wilvermyth, you get this cast and you kind of really like all of them. Like, they all get their own story and they all really matter and they all evolve in these interesting ways. And it's not the deepest thing in the world. But again, the fact that it works at all is a minor miracle and a kind of magic. And it's delightful to just watch it play out.
Yeah, like I got invested in the romance between two of my rando characters that I made, because it was like, I don't know, the little stories that they told were kind of cute. And I was really surprised that I grew to like these random characters that didn't exist an hour before.
And it's sufficiently fleshed out. Like, they all have a voice. They all have a character, a set of character traits that informs how they speak mm-hmm. and some of the things they're inclined to do. And on top of that, the structure of Voldermyth plays into this. Like, they will leave. They will set things up in chapter one that then get paid off in later chapters. And so it's not just procedurally generated in a stochastic way. They're building towards something. And yeah, the overall narrative of the campaigns is not really what's bringing you back. There's some stuff there, like this campaign sees you fighting this enemy, and so you learn more about this enemy type, and it kind of elaborates on that theme, and you find out where they came from and what they are and a little bit more of the lore. But again, mostly it's about the characters. You've got this small band of adventurers, and you recruit more. Some of them retire, some of them die, new ones get recruited, new ones get born. You have your character's son or daughter join them midway through the campaign. You're not going to really care a whole heck of a lot about all of them, but you're going to remember all of them.
Yeah.
You talked before about how the battles were a lot shorter than you thought they were going to be. Care to elaborate on that? Because I think it touches on this.
So one of the downsides of the game, I think, is that almost every battle, not all of them, there are some that break this mold, but especially in the early campaigns, almost every battle is just defeat all enemies. Sometimes additional enemies will spawn during the fight. Sometimes it's just a set number that are already on the map. But the maps are relatively small for the most part. Your heroes will appear in one area of the map. The enemies will be spread out on the rest. So you have two actions and a free action. Actions are moving, attacking, and some class-specific things. Free actions tend to be specific, class-specific things that maybe you will get via leveling up. It's turn-based. You wander up to enemies. You can attack them. Then the enemies will take their turn. But it doesn't take too long. The amount of health that everything has is pretty low. Your characters only start with 5 health. By the end, they might have 12 if they're a warrior. So the amounts are pretty low. The amount of damage you do is also pretty low. Generally, you know, a lot of your hits by the end might do 6 damage if they're not a crit, for example. Enemies generally will die in just a handful of hits. Things don't take too long. So it feels pretty good pacing-wise.
To my mind, and a lot of this is supremely subjective, I'm not going to pretend like this is some sort of standard that is easily discernible from the outside, but there's a world of difference to me, just taking a look at combat systems, for example, between the combat system of something like Beyond Good and Evil, which we felt was functional and uninspired, and the combat system, say, in Hellblade Senua's Sacrifice, which we thought was got the job done.
Yeah.
So sparse but effective. There's a lot of things in Wildermyth that are sparse but effective.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of the combat design feeds into that. You can't have more than 5 squad members enter a combat. By the end of a campaign, you're not going to be drowning in recruits anyway. But you might have like 10 dudes running around, but you can only bring 5 into any given fight. And the maps, as you say, are relatively constrained. The number of enemies you're fighting are going to be relatively constrained. Most enemies, unless they're bosses, will go down in a couple of hits.
Mm-hmm.
Most of your characters, unless they're warriors, tend to go down in a small handful of hits, things like that. And similarly, the graphics and the music are sparse but effective. The graphics are like literally papercraft dolls.
Yeah.
They march around like a 5-year-old playing with action figures or with dolls. They like move up and down like they're being moved. And then when they hit, they like angle over and you're like, rah! But it works.
It does. Yeah.
It gets the job done. And again, by the end of a campaign, even by Act 3, your characters are going to be festooned with battle scars, trinkets you picked up, souvenirs. They might have been transformed by some magical creature. They might be wrinkled because they're old. Their hair will change color, blah, 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 blah. So there's a lot of personality that gets through in these little papercraft models. And so the fact that they don't really animate is fine by me,
mm-hmm.
right? Again, sparse but effective. The music is mostly just a couple of strings. Seldom they have percussion. Again, sparse but effective. Like, a lot of this really does it. The tactical combat I find a little too easy.
Yeah.
I probably would have been happier if it were a little bit harder. Maybe a touch more sophisticated. Maybe like a 4th combat class, for mm-hmm. example. Not necessarily to make it longer or too complex or in-depth, but like, in particular, I find that mystics are super powerful. And
yes.
I don't know if that was your experience as well.
I had the experience that everyone felt pretty powerful at one time or another. It felt like mystics took a little bit more time to ramp up, but they could get crazy good with all the different things that you could do, especially with your talents when you leveled up, whatever they're called when you level up, the different abilities you can pick, because you could really specialize into certain, you know, you could specialize in stone and then do extra crazy stuff with stone, for example. So thought that was really cool. I felt like the difficulty of the game was almost the worst in the very first mission or two. And then once you start to get the very first mission I did, the campaign, it was fine, whatever. The second time that I did one, somebody got scarred on battle one. I was like, oh my God. But by the end of the game, everyone just would feel so powerful. It's like nothing could touch them pretty much. Like I'd have to get absolutely swarmed for anything bad to happen. So anyway, what I'm trying to say is, I agree. That could be a little bit too easy at times.
And I will say, for what it's worth, talking about Mystics, that I do really appreciate that the Mystics feel very different from a lot of other stock fantasy classes. Like, so there are three classes. You can be a warrior, you can be a hunter, guess what kind of weapon the hunter uses, or you can be a mystic. And the way Mystics operate is they don't cast spells, they interfuse with inanimate objects like a pile of rocks or a desk or a lamp or whatever, and they get special attacks that they can launch from those interfused objects that are keyed to the type of thing they've interfused with, which is really cool.
Yeah.
And their special abilities then let them play with that. Like, one that I really liked was you could cause a tree to arrive out of nowhere that you're automatically interfused from, and you could either launch a splinter blast from that tree, the tree would automatically pin things that you'd spawn next to. It's anyway, the magic system was very different from other magic systems in a way that, like, the generic warrior and hunter weren't.
Yeah.
And I would have liked it if the warriors and hunters felt a little bit more like the mystic, something I hadn't seen before, and or if there'd been like another class. Just, again, a little bit more tools to play with, because I really did feel like, although all my characters had different specializations and different skills, the pool of stuff to do in combat for the other two classes especially was much shallower than, say, the pool of narrative beats that could be hit.
Yes, absolutely agreed there.
Similarly, there's a bit of a parsimony of different armor types, but fortunately, there is a $5 DLC that can give you more armor types and more skins, so you can really make your characters stand out more visually. As I said, it is almost impossible to have two characters end up looking the same, even after a couple of chapters into a campaign, but their underlying armor type is repeated rather more than I would have liked. It was, I think, the biggest visual shortcoming in terms of the differentiation of the people. So I was very appreciative that there is. I haven't bought the DLC, but I appreciate that it's there.
I did actually. I did buy that and the Omen Road DLC yesterday, and I played one Omen Road campaign. The armor thing, it does add a decent amount of variety, because first of all, there's just a lot more armor that you can find lying around. And second, I just really like that each armor has its own special thing. Like, some of them will increase potency at the cost of armor value, stuff like that.
And so how is Omen Road? I haven't purchased it because it really seemed to... So it introduces a roguelite mode. And as I said, the actual combat for combat's sake in Wildermyth didn't strike me as immediately appealing. But what was your experience with it?
It was interesting. The combat is mostly unchanged. It's exactly as it is in the base game. Outside of combat, everything's completely different, because now you're choosing a path, kind of Slay the Spire-like. You know, there's a branching map, and you have to select what encounter you want to go to next. I played one of the story campaigns that they have. There was a lot of story. A lot. So much reading. So, actually, this is an aside. If you are one of those gamers that doesn't like to read, I don't think I would recommend Wildermyth.
Definitely not. Yeah, it's all text. There's no voice for anything. It would be impossible to voice, frankly. That would destroy the illusion of this cast of an unlimited number of people that you can then go adventure with. And it's worth saying, just for comparison's sake, since you talked about the strategic element of Omen Road, in base Wildermyth, the way that the battles are linked together by this sort of strategic map, where you're going and liberating parts of the area and then building up the local infrastructure so they'll give you more resources to let you upgrade things. Because that's another thing. Yeah. This was one area, I think, where Wildermyth was limited in a perfect way, and I wish more fantasy games would do this. There are no stores, and when you pick up a piece of equipment, you give it to somebody, and you can never give it to anybody else.
Yep.
And that is it. And it forces variety, and it means you don't spend time managing your inventory. It's just, ooh, a piece of candy, ooh, a piece of candy, ooh, a piece of candy. Who do I give these pieces of candy to? And then you move on with your life.
Yeah, I admit there were a couple times when I found that limitation a little frustrating.
Oh, too bad.
When I did my Omen Road campaign, I ended up having two mystics and a hunter. So I didn't have any warriors. And of course, the first three items I think I found were all like warrior items, like two-handed mace, a shield. Yep. And it's like, come on. So I just had to, I had to salvage them because I didn't have a warrior yet. Overall, I agree. I think the limitation was good. It was just frustrating in that one circumstance.
Yeah, I've been there too. It's surprising we haven't gotten to this specific detail, but I think it's a good place to kind of summarize. What did you think of the writing of Wildermyth? I ask because, so every little vignette, every little story scene, it identifies who wrote it. Most of them were written by Douglas Austin. He wrote the lion's share of the little vignettes. There were other Austins that wrote other ones, and there were other people that wrote other things. And I found that there was kind of a consistent authorial voice in a lot of the writing, which is good. It didn't feel scattered and stochastic. Mm-hmm. But by the same token, I have my misgivings about it. What did you think about the writing in Wildermyth?
I'm trying to think of the right way to describe it. So generally, I would say it was fine. There were some things that I thought were written in such a weird, flowery way. And I don't know if that's quite the right word, but where it's just like, I would literally have to reread something a couple times to be like, I need to make sure that I understand what this just said here. Because all of a sudden, this person just spoke in this weird roundabout way, or I don't know. So for the most part, I thought it was fine. But there were a few instances where it was just like, wait, okay, I feel like I'm reading something that was written like, I don't know, I'm having a hard time, like maybe almost, you know, all of a sudden I'm reading Pride and Prejudice. Not exactly. I would never crap on Pride and Prejudice.
Just because the guy's name is Austin doesn't mean you get to compare it to Pride and Prejudice. I think the word flowery is appropriate. Sometimes, so the character dialogue was often very arch. It didn't appear naturalistic. It didn't sound like the way people talk.
Yeah.
And it would alternate between flowery and baroque and overly stylized and what I would call Joss Whedon speak. So, look, let us acknowledge Joss Whedon won the cultural argument, right? And now almost everything is inflected by his kind of self-consciously witty, everyone-throwing quips kind of speech, regardless of setting, regardless of tone, regardless of context, right? Whether it's a superhero movie, whether it's a drama, whether it's anything else. And sure enough, here are these fantasy adventures. They sound like they're characters from a Joss Whedon story very often.
Yeah.
And then sometimes they say something, and I found this generally true of the narrator voice. So there's the people talking, but then there's also the narrator voice. It was very much at odds with that, and very sort of self-consciously baroque and stylized and flowery. So you might have something like, the footfalls get swallowed up by the stillness of a thousand secrets, right?
Yeah.
Like, and then one of the characters would say, like, shame the Thrixel, don't like torches, huh? And then someone might reply, it's like too far away to the torch store. You know, crap like that. I'm not necessarily communicating the quality, but it's that kind of tone.
Yeah.
And the two next to each other, I'm not a huge fan of. And frankly, even any of them in isolation wouldn't be my preference. But juxtaposed, I find it a little less strong than it could have been.
Yeah, sometimes it felt like they really wanted to hit an emotional note, and they would go into flowery language land. And sometimes I think it worked, and other times it was just like, whoa, that feels very different from everything else that I've been reading lately.
Well, all of this to say, though, quibbling about writing aside, the combat not necessarily being as satisfying as, say, an XCOM game. As I say, I'd just like to circle back to what I said before. Wildermyth is a kind of magic. The fact that it works at all, I think, is genuinely a minor triumph. And I have thoroughly enjoyed it. If you enjoy procedural generation in games and want to see what you can do with procedural generation, I cannot recommend Wildermyth enough. If you enjoy tactical RPGs, if you enjoy narrative games, any of these elements, Wildermyth is absolutely a delight and worth checking out. I have thoroughly enjoyed it, and I really think that it does something that no other game I've ever played does. I would never have thought that this kind of thing was possible. And yes, sometimes it stumbles, either because the writing gets so weird that I'm kind of driven out of the story, or because that story beat I had in chapter 3 of my second campaign was the same story beat, word for word, that I got deployed in chapter 1 of campaign 1.
Yeah.
But those moments are few and far between. And most of the time, I'm just marveling at how good Wildermyth is. And it's not just a tech demo. It's also fun to play, and it creates some memorable moments.
Yeah. So after my very first campaign with the randos, I decided to start naming all of my characters and designing them after my Final Fantasy XIV Free Company guildmates.
Sweet.
So that was really fun. I mean, a couple of them got married, and I had to be like, hee-hee, you two just got married.
Yeah, that might be playing with fire.
Yeah, but it was a really good time. It helped. I mean, I didn't need it in order to feel more attached to the characters, but it just added another level of fun stuff. Like the one I named after myself, and you know, my own character from Final Fantasy XIV, instantly got a Gorgon curse, so half of her face is like all, you know, stony, Gorgon-y looking. And it's like, oh man. But another one looks super cool. Like they have these crow wings and they have a cool scar on their face. So it's really fun seeing how the characters change and evolve. Oh, and I love that your characters from one campaign may show up in another campaign, or you can literally recruit the same character and you'll recruit a younger version of them. So if they were 85 years old when you ended the previous one, they don't start at 85 years old this time, although that might be funny. I was very surprised by how completely sucked in I got. And my main complaint was I saw one event in 3 of the campaigns I did. And it was like, come on, guys, what's going on here?
Yeah, I don't know how difficult this would have been. Sure. I think that the internal tracking of the game could have had some kind of timer to force,
to
prevent that kind of thing from happening. But again, as I say, minor miracle, stumbles on occasion, but absolutely miraculous.
Yeah, it was very good. I've been recommending it to a bunch of my friends this week.
Shockingly underappreciated. I don't see Wildermyth discussed as much as it ought to be. I mean, it's not I'm not going to pretend like it's some sort of hidden gem, but it's absolutely something more people need to experience, I think.
For what it's worth, so I played one of the random campaigns. I don't know if you necessarily need to do that. I don't think that you get much out of those that you wouldn't get out of just doing one of the story campaigns instead. But some of the story campaigns are pretty good. I've heard many good things about the moth-related one, although I haven't played that one yet.
The moth-related one is pretty cool.
Yeah.
So that's Wildermyth from Worldwalker Games. And now we're going to close things out, as we always do, with some shameless hyping of upcoming titles, what we call Shout. Caitlin, what would you like to shout out this week?
Okay, so I was looking around on upcoming games on Steam, and I saw this one that looked kind of wild. It's called Marry a Deep One, Innsmouth Simulator.
I don't know, Caitlin, sounds fishy.
So it releases December 8th, so it'll be out by the time this episode airs. It has a demo, which I downloaded but didn't have a chance to play. But it looks neat. You play as a cult leader, you manipulate villagers into joining your cult. I imagine you get some of them to marry a deep one. I don't know. It just seems kind of neat. So I'm looking forward to giving it a try.
I had thought that we had reached the apex of romance absurdity several years ago with Hatoful Boyfriend, where you're romancing pigeons. And clearly, I underestimated the creativity in the games industry.
It is unclear to me how much romance content there is in this game, but the name may be misleading.
Oh, I'm definitely going to have to try out this demo, that's for sure.
Yeah, for sure. How about you, Mark? Is there anything you want to shout out today?
Fighting games, Caitlin. It's been a hot minute since I've talked about fighting games. I like fighting games. I like playing fighting games. And yeah. Virtua Fighter is a stellar series, tragically underappreciated. It is incredibly simple and yet incredibly deep all at the same time. I also like some of the ones that are on the Virtua Fighter kind of same paradigm, like Dead or Alive, physics notwithstanding. But Virtua Fighter is coming back to modern platforms. There is Virtua Fighter 5 that is available on only the PlayStation, which is unfortunate. But it's coming back. More Virtua Fighter. Virtua Fighter 5 Revo is going to be released on Steam and all the modern consoles, and it is going to be a further retweaking of Virtua Fighter 5. I haven't really been deep into Virtua Fighter since Virtua Fighter 4 Evolution, which I play off and on in emulated contexts to this day. If you want to play a fighting game with a heavily pierced zombie judoka, I think it is definitely one of the top games where you get to do that. It's a competitive field, mind you. And I am looking forward to more Virtua Fighter. That's Virtua Fighter 5 Revo. Fighting games, Caitlin.
Fighting games. Yeah, I played, I think, 4 back in the day. Yeah, because it came out shortly before I went to college. And when I was at video game club in college, Virtua Fighter 4 was one of the big games. I mean, it was Virtua Fighter, Tekken, Soul Calibur 2 at one point. Lots of fighting games.
Yeah, I used to be heavy into Tekken. The direction that the series has gone is not the kind of game that I appreciate. Ever since Tekken 7, it's mostly been a game about kicking people along the ground in endless juggles that don't even look like juggles. And that's not my bag.
Yeah.
It's just not what I enjoy doing. The cut and thrust of Virtua Fighter is more to my taste, and so I'm very much looking forward to this. So I can once again be the worst fighting game player on the internet once more.
As long as you're having fun.
And that's going to do it for this week. Thank you all very, very much for joining us. For All My Best Friends Are Digital, we hope to see you again soon. We hope you get to play some good games, have some good times, and we hope to see you again back here next week.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in touch, you can reach us at allmybestfriendsaredigital@gmail.com. Hope to see you again soon.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.